Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The recent extreme weather has brought many problems with it. Well, joining us now with advice on how to deal with some of those problems are Lawrence and Alvin Ubell of Akron Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. Over the years, they have inspired millions of hesitant do-it-yourselfers to take repairs into their own hands. Alvin served as the household hints and safety editor with Family Circle magazine for over 2 decades. He was a regular on ABC TV's Good Morning America for 5 years, also on ABC Talk Radio Network for 5 years. Lawrence is the company's president and chief inspector, licensed in New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, and Massachusetts, and he's an EPA-certified lead inspector and assessor in New York. They join us now to offer their advice to you, our listeners. And you can call us now. Start calling right now if you wish. 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Alan, Larry, welcome back to our show.
Great to be here.
Absolutely.
Alvin, you founded Accurate Building Inspections in 1961. Do you know how many building inspections your company has done over the past 6 decades?
A couple of thousand. I would imagine.
Not a couple of thousand. I figure that at this point, I've been doing this since 85, and I've done over 10,000 myself.
Wow.
So I would say probably the company's probably somewhere in the 30,000 to 40,000 range.
Is it mostly houses that you do, or have you also inspected apartments?
Yes. During the beginning of the business, it was mostly 1 and 2 family homes, some commercial properties, some multiple dwellings, but today, it's a large preponderance of our work is actually co-ops and condos for 2 reasons. One, because that's what's being sold. And back in when we started, they were just, you know, rental apartments. Now people own them and they want to know what their underlying liability would be. And in addition, the overall envelope of the building people want to know aside from their apartments.
And Alvin, your website says you inspect everything from outhouses to skyscrapers.
That has happened over the years.
You did an outhouse?
We had a few outhouses and farms that still have outhouses. And
they're very simple to inspect.
But my division of Accurate Building Inspectors came is we do expert testimony for people who have personal injury, property damage, and we give the court an idea of what really happens and why it happens that causes injury by loss for a person or monetary losses.
And that's because people haven't done the inspections before they've sold the house?
Not necessarily. It could be because somebody repaired the building at one time and they made a mistake, or they didn't do it correctly, or maybe something came by that through deterioration and erosion causes an accident, an elevator, stairs, or something like that, a handrail that is missing that needs to be installed. People are neglectful on things around the house that are actually safety devices, but they look at it that it's in their way or aesthetically not acceptable. And that's we get involved in that kind of a condition.
In other words, a technical explanation of what caused the condition that caused the accident.
And we have calls coming in. I'll get to them in just a moment. But what are the kinds of things you're looking for, Larry?
For me, it goes anywhere from improperly installed equipment to water infiltration. That's a big concern. These days, we have many more piece of equipment to discern the water coming in that could be hidden, whether it's the use of a moisture meter or the use of infrared thermal imaging, infrared cameras. There are also to see if electrical installations these days, with so many flipped houses, renovations, sometimes some of the work is not done as per code or actually getting permits and licensing. So these are the things that we have to be up on our game about checking out. The biggest things are electrical and plumbing, heating equipment, that sort of thing.
Yeah, many people, you go through a building, and most of the properties that we are involved with, which in within the state of New York, it has building codes. And people sometimes don't like the idea that building codes are telling me what to do. What building codes are really safety proposals or safety requirements. What they're trying to do is prevent people from killing themselves, their family, or strangers, or anything like that. And that's what building codes are all about, and they are very, very necessary.
Let's take some calls. Our number here is 212-209-2877. WBAI, you're on the air. Speak to Alvin and Lawrence Ubell.
Hey.
Hello, Hi.
Hi, what's up?
Yeah, I have a three-story townhome up here in Yonkers, built in the mid-30s.
Mm-hmm.
And electrical is antiquated, to say the least. And it seems like a gigantic undertaking. I just want some thoughts on how to begin to approach the idea of upgrading electrical throughout the house.
Okay, so one of the things that you need to do is you need to get an electrician in there. One of the things, the biggest problem with older buildings is older electrical wiring. And so the wiring needs to be either upgraded completely or the installation of arc fault circuit interrupters. Arc fault circuit interrupters are a device that encases an arc between wires. The wires are loose, which is very common in older construction. This will shut down that particular circuit and prevent a fire from happening. But you really are starting. We'd have to actually make an assessment of what's going on with the service coming into the building. How much electrical service amperage do you have? You need to upgrade from there. And then how many electrical outlets or distribution is throughout the building and upgrade there too. But you are talking about a lot of money. For budgeting purposes, it wouldn't be a bad idea to just go through the house and count up how many more outlets you think you need, or wall switches, or lights, or ceiling boxes, and times that between $200 and $300, and that will give you your budgeting point.
Are any of these things tax deductible?
Only against the sale of the property.
Hmm.
So when you sell the property,
you have to lay out tens of thousands of dollars sometimes because something went wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That's just tough luck.
Well, it's tough luck now. It's not tough luck when you sell it. Okay.
And it's tough luck if you don't do it because you may burn down the house.
Yeah, that would be even tougher luck.
Will there be more than just electrician needed? I mean, knocking holes in the walls, et cetera?
Well, knocking holes in the walls to run wires is the least of the issue because basically you cut a hole in the wall, you snake the wires through, you put in the electrical box where you want it, and then you patch the hole. Patching holes are easy. It's running the wires, it's getting the new electrical equipment, it's putting ground fault circuit interrupter outlets in the wet areas. It's those types of things that actually cost the money. The repairs after the equipment's gone in is kind of, you do want to do this as part of a general renovation because you don't want to have a brand new painted house and then start popping holes in it. So it's part of an overall, plan, as far as that's concerned.
Does that help?
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for calling. Again, our number is 212-209-2877. If you want to speak to the gurus, I opened by mentioning that we've been going through some pretty extreme weather recently. What are some of the things that you'd advise pretty much everyone in our audience, whether they're homeowners or apartment dwellers or or even are living in that outhouse that you, well, you might examine at some
point. One of the things I would tell them not to do is try to use their stoves and their other equipment to heat their house. This is really, especially if it's a gas stove or even an electric stove. You just could overload the circuit if you open up everything that's electrical and everything that is gas. There are dangers in that. You got to rely on heating your building through the central heating system. And if you need, if your electrical service can accommodate it, you can buy an electrical heater, but that has to be underwrited, laboratory listed. There are some units that are coming in from out of the country that are not listed, and it could have consequences by causing a short circuit or something to that effect.
And on that note, you also want to have make sure those electric heaters have knockover disconnects. Some of them are, they have a small mercury switch inside that if it's not standing straight. One I just bought has a little button on the bottom, so if it flips on its side, the button disengages and it shuts it off. The other thing, which is more important and which is on the same theory of thought of not using your oven, is do not use fuel heaters indoors, such as kerosene heaters or propane heaters indoors. You are going to kill yourself or your family. It's not even a question. These kinds of equipment is like running your car in your house without venting it outside. These are very dangerous. They produce a lot of carbon monoxide, and it will kill you, especially if you go to bed with them on at night. You will not wake up the next morning. So I don't want to impress upon that more. We also are very sensitive to the fact that if you don't have heat and the only heat source is your oven, you're probably going to turn it on. I mean, you're not going to freeze at night if you have to. But as far from I think what Leonard was going toward was, what do you do to just stay a little bit warmer when everything's working fine? And that is close the shades at night. Mm-hmm. That's a biggie. Close your shades, close your curtains. That keeps the heat in. The windows are your biggest single heat loss in a room. The resistance to heat loss of windows is very low. It just lets the heat right out. So cover up your windows.
And they let the cold in.
Well, actually, that's not really the way it works. It actually is letting the heat out.
Yes. Okay, you may feel the cold air coming in. It may be a perception, but actually, what's taking place physically is the heat is dissipating.
There's no such thing as cold loss. It's heat loss. Okay, but that being the case, covering up the windows really helps. There was an interesting article in the New York Times a couple of years ago about how everyone always complains that New York City buildings are overheated. The joke around the rest of the country is, what's a New York City thermostat? A window. Any pre-war building, people always have the windows open when you drive by. That's actually a part of the design when these buildings were built, that these buildings felt a way to keep people healthy was to keep the windows open so all the germs go out. Mm-hmm. Well, now it seems we're
waiting. Fresh air.
Fresh air. But that's when also we were burning. I don't know what they were talking about because we were burning coal back then, so I don't know how much fresh air you were letting in when we're burning all this coal. But right now, I think buildings need to readjust their heating systems, and so they don't have those windows open because those are a waste of energy.
And I want to return to this subject in a little while, but I want to take some more calls. Our number again, 212-209-2877. WBAI, you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon, Leonard. And good afternoon to your guests. I would wonder if your guests could explain to me the procedure or the procedural process that goes into building demolition in terms of demolishing a house. I mean, what are the criteria that establish it for demolition and actual demolition process? Is the owner notified? What's the process?
The first thing you have to do is you have to
Let's back up a second. Are you demolishing a building or is a building next door?
No, I'm not demolishing a building. A building that I own was demolished by your department.
Not my department. Oh, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Well, I don't know about your department.
No, I don't have a department. I have a company. I'm a private person. I'm a capitalist. Okay? Okay?
I tune in late, and I thought you guys
worked for me. We're a private building inspection service. That's what we do.
Oh, okay. Okay. But maybe you could give me some insight.
And what was the circumstances leading up to?
Well, the circumstances of my situation was my property was stolen, and people that went in and they wanted to flip it, and so they went in with a thing to clear the property, just gut it and redo it in the way they were going to redo it. But the whole thing, the whole scam got blown up, so they got exposed, and they left the building as is. Now, the structure was still intact. I mean, all of everything was there, but it was all of the bearing walls were still there. Everything was pretty much intact, but the property, because of the legal stuff, was left in an abandoned state for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, the buildings department, a big article came out in the Times, and the next, actually that same year that the article came out, they went in and demolished the property without any kind of notification or anything, mm-hmm. So I just thought you guys would have some kind of insight.
Yeah, I got a quick question.
Can we blame this on Amazon?
Yeah, I have a quick question. Is that, did you have homeowner's policy on this house?
No, I didn't have any homeowner's policy on the property.
But the procedure is that they do really have to notify the owner. But sometimes whatever was written in the documents at the buildings department or the housing department was not completed. They couldn't find you, maybe, or they do send you the tax things and everything else.
Let me just say, and I don't think we're the right people for this, but the bottom line is that if the buildings department or the health department deems something unsafe for the community, they can really take whatever actions they want.
Well, like an eminent domain type of situation.
Well, it's more health and safety, and so it's a little bit different. I mean, that land underneath where that building used to be is still yours. It's just there's no building anymore. And unfortunately, it seems that the people who stole your house probably are out of the picture now, and you can't find them.
No, that's they're totally out of the picture. I mean,
I don't know what to say. I think at this long, you have a vacant lot that you're probably going to put up for sale.
But you never know. You should get a lawyer that deals in that.
I'm working on it. It's just something that I thought you guys, like I said, mistaken.
Not a problem.
Okay.
Thank you for calling us. Again, the number is 212-209-2877. My guests are Alvin and Lawrence Ubell of Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. And let's take another call. Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
Is that me?
You. Yes, this is you, and this is us.
Very good. There's an apparatus now that is being placed in buildings that exudes or puts out radiation. How can we stop these from coming into our buildings?
What kind of devices are you speaking of?
Smart meters.
I have no knowledge that they're putting out radiation. So I really can't speak to that. That's something I'll have to research.
Yeah.
This is the first I've heard that these smart meters are putting out radioactive material. I just have to also say,
what about smoke detectors?
They put out radioactive material too, especially the ionization ones, which is ironic, even though it's called ionization. It's ironic that they're not very good at smoke detectors anyway. The photoelectric ones, which basically uses a light, are much better. So I definitely a photoelectric kind of guy.
But we it's okay for the for smoke detectors to emit radiation. The law allows that. How serious are the levels?
I think it's I'm not going to comment on it exactly, but it's below getting an X-ray, way below getting an X-ray. Well, so I think it's way below even taking an airplane ride.
Still. So. We breathe in it all night.
Yeah, well, we don't breathe in, and it kind of just radiates on us. You get a nice tan.
Sleep as far away from the smoke detector as you can.
Exactly. That's why we put them on the ceiling.
Should we take another call?
Yes, sir.
Okay, BAI, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I'm trying to find out which electric heaters are the safest, economical, and best.
That depends upon what each electrical heater gives out a certain amount of BTUs, and sometimes the manufacturer of each and every one will tell you how much square footage this will heat up in a certain period of time. They usually come with a table, something like that. Some heaters, like I have a tiny heater that I have in my own office, it's just enough to heat my feet up, and I feel very comfortable. The idea is to get something that puts your house into a comfort zone and not overly heat your house. What you should keep, just keep a comfort range. The best thing is to get maybe some sort of thermostat, a thermometer that's mounted on the wall someplace, and don't let it go over 70 degrees, or keep it within that realm, and then turn it down, because they're all adjustable of how much heat will come out of each kind of heating device.
Well, but I think this listener also wants to know whether there are preferred brands. Is there a way to determine which brands are the best?
Yeah, but one thing I want to go back a little bit. Most space heaters are rated not by particularly BTUs, but by watts. And that's how many watts it consumes, like whether it's 1,500, 2,000, 2,500. And that's kind of the measurement that we use. As far as what I like, I have to say, for keeping a space warm and comfortable without having...
A
studio apartment. I like the oil-filled space heaters, because they tend to have a less fluctuating range, and it's less apt that you'll feel the heat coming off of it, as opposed to one of the space heaters that either has a fan in it where you feel the air blowing around the space, or those parabolic heaters, which basically you feel like a ray gun at your chest. And so I don't find those to be quite comfortable.
They're also noisy at night.
You see the fan ones also, but the oil-filled ones tend to be very quiet. And so those are the ones, and they also roll around on wheels, so it makes it easy to move it. Those are the ones I like.
What about quartz?
Say it again?
Quartz. What about quartz?
Quartz
heaters.
I have no experience with that, so I'm sorry to say. I don't really use a lot of space heaters, so it's not really my area of expertise.
Well, thank you for calling. Mm-hmm. Talking about heaters, when I grew up, everybody had radiators, which were those odd-looking things that were usually under the windowsill, and they had a valve.
Well, you can.
And now a lot of new buildings have HVACs instead.
Right.
Is there something to be said for either?
Can I sound like Winona for a minute? Don't get me started on that. I have to say that. That was, you know, the radiators being placed under the windows was for a reason, because that was a heat loss. So you wanted to keep a shield of heat around those windows. Right now, people are using what you call HVAC or ductless air conditioning units or mini splits to
heat. They give you heat in the winter and air conditioning in the summer.
I have a couple of fundamental issues with it. One, when they have to make heat in the wintertime and we go through an extreme period of cold, like anything 20 degrees and lower, they really have a hard time keeping up, and they do struggle with keeping the temperature up to the room up to temperature. And a lot of these, and I've been involved in a couple of projects where there's so much glass in the space that the glass loses so much heat that they can't keep up with the heat demand. What I find in higher end apartments and houses where they do that is they put a heating element under the window to compensate for it. The other thing is...
I was at a friend's house where he had HVAC, and every time it turned on, it sounded like a train was coming into the station. They could be very loud,
too. Actually, then that one might be broken, because most of the ones I find are very quiet. The problem I have fundamentally is that everything you do for heating, you do 180 degrees opposite for cooling. So basically, you heat from the perimeter, but you cool from the core of the building. You heat from down low, but you air condition from up high. So it's really hard. Everything you do is a compromise between these two heating and cooling fundamentals. And so you're compromising constantly. And here's the other crazy part is they usually set up these systems for cooling, which I find odd in New York because we only cool for 4 to 5 months a year when we heat from anywhere between 6 and 8 months a year. So our heating is what we're doing more of. And I'm not really sure where this all comes from, but I am a devout, and this is probably the only thing I'm a devout about, is I'm a devout separation of heating and air conditioning. Because one thing, make one thing do one right and make the other thing do it right.
Of course, if you rent an apartment, you have no choice in the matter.
You have no choice. No, unless you don't rent it, because I am a baba. Yeah. I am. do I seem like I'm done?
Yeah, no, you're not done.
Okay. The thing is that I'm probably the only person who went around when I went to look for a house who bought the house because of the kind of heating system it had. But most people are not knowledgeable of that. And also rentals also. You take what you can get, what's in your price range.
But there's also another thing. You can buy a humidifier that puts humidity into the atmosphere. If the relative humidity in your house is below 50%, you're going to be cool. You're going to feel cool even when there's the right temperature, because the evaporation of the perspiration is moving out of your body very quickly. So the idea is to compensate for low relative humidity is to buy some sort of device. Or even put if you have a pan of water, put it on top of a radiator that you happen to have. By no means should you have boiled water in your kitchen in order to produce that
moisture. I always wondered
why
my mother put that pan of water on the
radiator.
Yes,
that works very well, because if the relative humidity goes up above 50%, you will feel comfortable even when it's cold.
But I'm also going to say, doing that, be very aware of what's going on at the windows. And if you start getting a lot of condensation at the windows, you're over-humidifying the space, and you can cause mold issues at the window trim, and so on. So
be
very, very, is a balance.
Caller, does that help?
No, he's gone.
Okay, let's take another call.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Hi, BAI, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you, gentlemen. I got three quick questions with the heating.
Yes.
Okay, how is radiant floor heating, where they run the tubing underneath with the plates?
Well, no, the way that works
ask all three, and then we'll take care of them. First, he wants to know about floor radiant heating.
Right, floor radiant heating. I think it's a great idea. I have two concerns about it. One is that if it's installed on a cellar floor or a floor that's on grade, you got to insulate below it, or else all the heat goes into the soil. So that's number one. Number two, I like it a lot because it definitely heats you up from your feet up, and therefore you feel warm. Also, less of the hot air stacks up at the ceiling, so you get most of the heat around you. The downside to them is, one, if one of the pipes ever leaks, but these days they're getting a lot better at it. And the other issue is that the response time of heat is very slow. To get that kind of system to raise one temperature, to go up one temperature, could take an hour to 2 hours to move it 1 degree, because it has to warm up this entire mass of the floor system to work. But I do like it, and they are very effective. And it's nice to walk around that kind of floor on bare feet. What was the other question?
Do they heat evenly?
Yes.
Now, my thought is, you know, as it goes down the pipe, it's losing heat.
Well, you create multiple loops. It's not just one loop for the whole space. You'll have, let's just give an example of a 1,000-square-foot space. You may have 5 individual loops within that 1,000-square-foot space. So the temperature going into each one of the pipes at the beginning is the same, and coming out is the same. Is lower, but it's not just like traveling the entire space and coming out lukewarm. You follow what I'm saying? No, there's designs.
The more loops, of course, the more even it's going to heat.
Right, and that's what they do.
Okay. Somebody figures out a thing for that.
Exactly, a mechanical
engineer. And what was your other question?
You said no to propane heaters. Now, my question is, they sell these indoor natural gas fireplaces that are ventless.
Yeah, not
What's
a big fan.
Difference?
I'm not a fan of that either, because the problem is that two things. One, the ventlessness, 75% of the byproduct of combusting fossil fuel is water. So you're throwing all this water that has all these other chemicals in it into the air. And so you're breathing it in. That's not so good. The other thing is that if that particular gas space heater starts malfunctioning and producing carbon monoxide, now you're breathing in carbon monoxide, mm-hmm. and that's even worse. So while we're on the carbon monoxide kick, make sure that you have carbon monoxide detectors, but also the standard carbon monoxide detector is a little wanting on the side of really protecting people. I'm into low-level carbon monoxide detectors like Defender. They make a low-level carbon monoxide detector called Defender, the LL6010, and it starts noting the carbon monoxide level at around 5 parts per million. The standard carbon monoxide detector doesn't even go off until 70 parts per million, and that's sustained for 4 hours. So if it dips back below 70, it resets the clock. So definitely carbon monoxide detectors. But you definitely don't. I'm not a big fan of the non-venting gas fireplaces.
Yeah, I was wondering about that.
Yeah, you're
like
wondering correctly.
Either.
Yeah,
it's almost the same as using your stove to heat up your kitchen.
What about the old-fashioned using wood fireplace?
Well, no, he's talking about a non-venting fireplace.
No, I understand.
I do like the gas venting fireplaces. Oh. They're fine. I like wood venting fireplaces. They're fine, too. I think they're very romantic, even though the reality is they suck out more heat than they put in. But let's not get that. Let's not go down that road.
Depends on how close you sit to them.
Yeah. Well, everything behind you gets all the heat. I mean, if you ever go over to an open fireplace and it doesn't even have a fire in it, you could feel the air rushing up the chimney.
Okay.
Okay.
And when the gentleman talked about the radiation, he was talking about electromagnetic radiation coming from the
Is that what you meters. Think? You think that's what he was talking about?
Oh, definitely, definitely,
okay,
definitely.
Okay, that's different because, and at this point, like a lot of other things that are in the news right now, there is no hard evidence one way or the other that it has any effect on us. There was a conference a bunch of years ago where they got engineers, medical people, and after this long conference, everyone said, well, what do we know now? He says, not a lot, not in the same amount that we knew when we walked in here. Not a lot. So I don't know what we're supposed to do with that.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's go right to one of the calls. Okay. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, Leonard. Thanks very much for taking the call. My question, we're thinking of moving, and we're thinking to either buy a condo or a small house. And I'm worried, I wonder about mold in the new property. And is there a way, I know there's a way to detect moisture in the walls, but is it possible that there's still mold even if there's no moisture?
Well,
without tearing out the wall, is there a way to detect that?
Well, there is all of us are equipped with that device. It's our nose. And I have to say, you laugh, but it's actually quite true. You walk into a building, and especially from outside, and outside hopefully doesn't smell terrible, and you come into the house, you should be aware immediately about what things smell like. I remember having a conversation with my daughter, who's a veterinarian, how I told her I did an inspection of a house that smelled weird and trying to smell. And she said, that's so cool because she uses smell to do her veterinarian diagnoses since her charges don't speak very well. And so smell is a very important tool to a home inspector. Just one thing people have to understand about mold. Mold is not the problem.
Well, what does the mold smell like?
Well, there are different. It depends upon what the mold may be. In other words, mold could be growing on, say, some live tissue, or it could be growing on vegetation. Those two types of molds have different odors.
But what about the ones that grow on the wall?
That has a.
Is that like for moisture?
That has a musty mold. But mold is growing where there is a nutrient that it could survive. Because mold in generally is some type or species of like mushrooms. And sometimes they grow better in the darkness because they don't need any, they don't take a photosynthesis. They don't need it. So they grow and they give off different kinds of odors.
So
and
I want some chanterelles to be growing on my wall.
But can we get back to the original question?
Go ahead.
Instead of the biology lesson here? The bottom line is that mold is, first of all, what does mold smell like? I don't know. It's hard to describe. What does lobster smell like? I mean, it's describing smell, but if it smells
well, the reason I asked is because you said you have to use your nose to.
But when you go, it's a musty.
You just know that something weird is there.
It's a musty smell. Most people do know what it smells like. But if a house does not smell the same inside that it smells outside, then there's definitely a problem. It's like fish stores. Fish stores shouldn't smell at all.
Can you spot them? Because I remember talking to you in the past about molds on the wall, and you used to. Remember Alvin used to say when he was working for Rust-Oleum that you should put aluminum or some kind of metallic paint down over the mold and then just paint over that, and that would pretty much keep it under control.
No, you got half of that right. Okay. No, that's when you have a water stain and you don't want the stain bleeding through after you've taken care of the problem. But getting back to this woman's issue is that mold is not the problem. Mold is the symptom of an underlying problem, which is usually uncontrolled moisture or leakage or water infiltration. So if there's a mold issue, then there's another problem. It could be high levels of humidity in the basement. That means they might have a continuing flooding problem, or they might have just a situation where a lot of moisture comes in, especially people that are close to the waterfront or on mountains where water can't absorb into the ground easily enough. So you get this high level of humidity. Even my house, I have to run a dehumidifier. I have to have it operational 365 days a year, or else I start getting a moisture issue in my house. These are just things that people need to know. As far as mold in your house, every house has mold in it. It's whether it's active or dormant. Any house can be made to have all that mold become active once you raise the humidity level enough. Mold needs four things to survive. You need mold spores, you need the right temperature, you need the right amount of moisture, and you need mold food. And so those things, if all those things come into the right combination, you're going to get mold. But usually it's uncontrolled water or moisture that's causing the problem. And that you need to know when you walk through and be aware. Be aware of your surroundings. That's really all I can say.
And most often, mold does grow in those areas where they have some sort of nutrient. And that is usually in the kitchen areas.
When you mean nutrients, you mean mold food.
Mold food.
Okay.
Mold food.
Okay.
Have a nutrient in order to survive. So the bathroom is one place where you have high relative humidity when you're taking a shower or bathing.
That's why it's good to have venting in the bathroom.
Well, actually, the odd thing is,
that is why.
Well, it's very important. It's just no one ever turns a fan on or opens a window.
Yeah,
but the thing is that in a bathroom, there's not really a lot of nutrients for the mold to grow on. So what it really grows on is the dead skin cells that are all over the place. And that's why you get such a weird pattern on bathroom tile when mold starts to grow.
That's right.
Did that help?
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to another call. BAI, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. Oh, Leonard, it's such a pleasure to have you on WBAI, and such an interesting show and so relevant. Mm-hmm. And as I'm listening, I'm getting out my humidifier. That was a very very good tip about keeping the place warm. Here's my issue. I live in a two-story house on Staten Island, and I have one thermostat downstairs, and it's a temperature gradient issue. If the temperature downstairs is, say, 65 degrees, the temperature upstairs could be 75 or 80 degrees. How do I equalize the temperature between the two floors is my question.
Preaching to the choir, brother.
Not uncommon.
No, it's not. I'm an islander also, and I have to say that my house, when I first bought it, had a single zone heating system, and I like to sleep in cool weather at night, 66, 67 degrees. That problem was is in the morning when we went downstairs, it was like 62 degrees downstairs, which is the same problem you're having, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Especially when it's cold. The colder it gets, the greater the difference in the temperature.
Yes, yes, I get that. And also,
this is not unique to Staten Island.
No, it's not. Not at all. It's unique to houses.
It's unique to all houses.
It's unique to all single-zone houses. And I have to say, what kind of heat do you have?
Oil heat.
No, that's the heating method.
It's radiators with the steam.
It's a steam system. Well, with you, you actually have a little bit of what you can do is you can increase the orifice on the steam vents or the air vents that are on the radiator so they get hotter quicker, or reduce the size upstairs so it takes longer for those to get hot, and you might be able to balance out the system. If it was a hot water system, I would have recommended turning it into a two-zone house, which is what I ended up doing in my house. Is now I have one zone for upstairs and one zone for downstairs, and they're completely independent.
But with your house, which you have steam on, there are adjustable steam vents for the radiator, and that's what you should get, because then they'll have numbers on it, 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to 10. Mm-hmm. And so what you do is, it's a trial and error kind of thing. If it gets a little too hot, what you got to do is turn it down to a lower number. If it gets a little too cold, turn it up to a higher number. And you just keep doing that until you balance out the house.
And then there's another thing. If the thermostat is still downstairs, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. What you could put on the radiators upstairs are devices called Danforth valves, and those are thermostatically controlled for steam. And what it does is it will limit the amount of heat upstairs, so you won't get as much heat upstairs and push it and keep it downstairs. So there are a lot of options out there. There's a lot of material saying trying to balance a steam system, and Google that, go in that direction. I'm assuming it's a single pipe steam system. And so there are many variables or many options as far as getting you to balance your system. It's going to be challenging, but you can make it better.
Okay.
Yes, gee, thanks so much. And making it a two-zone, which means what, constructing barriers? Or just
no, a two-zone on a steam system is very difficult.
And very expensive.
Yeah, very expensive. What another option would be to either keep the upstairs as steam, and then, because downstairs is closer to the basement, is just put a whole new heating system in for the first floor and have two separate heating systems. But now we're talking some real money.
I see. Thank you so much. That was very informative, very helpful. Gives me good directions to go.
Hope. That's what we're about, hope.
Good luck.
And we're going to take another call now. Okay. BAI, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, sir. I have a 5 to 6 year old steam boiler in the basement, and it's using too much water. So I know the problem is that the steam is going through the chimney. You know, there must be an opening somewhere. Are there any men that know how to fix the radiator part of the steam boiler so that the problem goes away to
Wait,
fix it for
Well,
that?
First of all, I doubt that the steam is going up up the chimney.
It is, because I can see it. I know about
and
it.
How old is this That's boiler?
About 6 years old. What it is,
Hold on a second. I need to understand. 60 or 6?
6.
6 years old, you should definitely call up the boiler company. It should be, if there is a leak in between the sections of the boiler, you should call the boiler manufacturer.
Well, they put it on the people that are saying that you had leaks somewhere, and because you used too much water, the oxidation causes this type of nonsense. And I found out the castings are made in China, you know what I mean? So this.
But still, I'm gonna still say that if you're getting leakage between the sections of the boiler, if this is or the steam boiler itself is a steel boiler and it's leaking, then
it doesn't show. There's no droplets to the floor. I mean, it's leaking. You know, it's either the top or the side. You know, it's going up.
And it's not leaking through the condensate return pipe.
No, there's no pipe leaking. There's nothing. Can I ask you a question? Are any men that good at it? Because I heard that in big apartments, it's quite a problem. But because they have automatic water feeds and they don't know what's going on. You know what I mean?
Well,
and they got guys that know how to fix it. Is there any companies you know that do this?
No, and I have to say that I don't recommend anybody anymore, because that stuff always blows back on me, and I really don't enjoy that. It's bad enough.
What about this? What about when they say this thing where you seal the thing, that boiler seal?
Sometimes that does work. You pour it in and you let it.
It does solidify. It works, but it's a temporary fix.
Is it bad for the low water cutoffs and the other things that are on the boiler?
Well, you have what they call a low water cutoff and an automatic.
Well, we know
feed.
That. We all know that. But you're asking, is yours an internal low water cutoff or an exterior? External.
No, low water, just a little point in it that you can clean. But I say the other ones are pressure trolls and all that.
It shouldn't be a problem with those, because all the pressure trolls have those pigtail siphons on them, so they shouldn't. You shouldn't be getting
this. It doesn't
clog them up enough, they try that.
You shouldn't know.
I feel like I'm at a meeting of plumbers.
No, there's a lot of guys they talk about putting putty up there, you know, like the epoxies and all of this, and you know.
Well,
if there's a leak, if this is a cast iron boiler, it's leaking, it's very difficult to fix it. If it is a steel boiler and it has a little leak someplace, somebody can come in and weld it up. That's quite permanent, and it really works.
Yeah.
But you have to we have to know. What kind of boiler it is, who's the manufacturer, and what is the number on it so that we can look it up and analyze whether your boiler is fixable.
Thank you so much for your call. This is Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. My guests are Alvin and Lawrence Ubell of Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn. We have a little more time left, and we're going to take another call. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Go ahead.
What's up?
Hello?
Yes.
Hi. My name is Helen. I'm calling about some information that you might have on, is it worth it to take out some sort of a policy insuring my heating system that you're always receiving advertisements for? And
you know, I'm going to say that to, again, what it costs a month or a year, you know, you have to crunch your own numbers. But I would say that in a typical one-family house these days, a new heating system, a new boiler replacement is about $8,000 or $9,000 at least. And so... what's the cost of that per year?
But isn't that normally covered by the homeowner's insurance?
No. Wear and tear is not part of homeowners. Not at all.
No,
not wear and tear.
No,
especially
because I live in a condo, so I just had the boiler replaced, the hot water boiler.
Yeah.
Now I receive information all the time about I don't know what you call it,
you also have to read it and see what the limitations are. That's the big deal. A lot of times if they will replace the boiler, well, it was the circulator pump that died. And they say, oh, that's not part of this. You know,
exactly,
so you have
to. Because the paper that I received had a long list of very small print.
Of exclusions.
Covered.
Yeah, it's amazing. The exclusions are in 8-point type, and what they want to sell you is in 14-point type.
Exactly.
I know.
So,
yeah.
Yeah, so it doesn't really pay,
Well, you have to read it over and see what they would really cover. But
yeah.
I'm not sure. I can't really talk about that. One thing I do want to talk about, which is above and beyond this, is that because the weather right now is actually, we're in a bit of a, it's cold, but a bit of a reprieve. It's a good time for people to clean out their gutters and leaders. It's really an important thing. Clean out your gutters and leaders, your roof drains and so on, because if we start getting a lot of snow again, then those leaves are going to make things worse. You get ice dams, you get blockage, you get water leakage. So now's a good time to do that once, three to four times a year, cleaning of your gutters and leaders.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks so much.
No problem.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I was wondering, both of you have also given, as Alvin mentioned earlier, expert testimony in various courts.
Mm-hmm.
What does that involve? What kinds of cases what would be typical?
Well, staircases are very popular. That is the
People tripping over stairs?
Tripping over stairs, falling down, and injuries could run from anything from broken bones to not getting up at all.
After car accidents, stairs and ramps are...
Second to automobile accidents.
Yes.
Stair accidents.
So people sue because the stairs weren't fixed properly?
Fixed is one thing. Designed is another thing. A stair being built by an amateur who doesn't understand how the tread riser relationships are very important, that your psychomotor function in walking up and down a stair is consistent and not arbitrary. Each one is different, and that would cause somebody to
fall. But we're all different. Somebody who's 7 feet tall would have a very different tread from somebody who's 5 feet tall.
You know, it's interesting you say that, but the crazy part is that our brain is amazing in the sense that When you take that first step, going up a set of steps or down a set of steps, your brain takes that measurement and it repeats that measurement over and over and over again until you're at the top or the bottom of the steps. So regardless how tall you are, the height of the steps, your brain already took that measurement. The problem is when one of those steps are not the same height. And there was a great video. I don't remember what local news station did it, but they pointed a camera at a train station, an underground, a subway station, and they showed person after person after person after person tripping in exactly the same place because those steps were – that step was just a little bit high.
Yes. I've even noticed it myself at a diner that had steps, and every patron that came out of the had to grab a hold of the handrail, had to grab a hold of the handrail. Also, stairs without handrails. A stair without a handrail is an accident waiting to happen. You have to – a handrail is a safety device that if you falter, you have something to grab a hold of. And you should have handrails on both sides, regardless of what the law says.
Rarely do.
Yes. The handrails have to be on both sides because if a person is right-handed or left-handed, it has to accommodate some
– And also finger clearance. The distance between the handrail and the wall. How many times you put your hand on handrail and your fingers get pinched? Well, there have been situations where it's been worse.
Okay, so let's say that I discover that there is an uneven, that my stairs are uneven.
Yes.
How do I have them fixed?
You have to tear the whole thing apart practically in most instances and rebuild it. That's sometimes with a wooden stair, it's a lot easier. Make them equal, consistent, by putting special wedges in. But with a concrete unit or something like that, where they're out of stride, that sometimes you have to rebuild this whole stair.
And most of the mistakes of steps are usually at the bottom tread or the top tread or the top step because the installer doesn't accommodate for a finished floor. So what happens is you have all these steps that are, let's say, 7 inches. You get it to the top step because of the finished floor. Now it's 7 3/4 or 8 inches high, and you trip every time. Or at the bottom, the floor is a little high, so now the tread is only 6 inches, and you smash your foot and into the floor at the bottom.
And the worst one is when the top is no good or inconsistent. Why? Because if you trip at the top, you find yourself at the bottom. You're falling down a set of steps is like falling off of a mountain with things sticking out, which is each step that you hit and you bounce all the way down.
We don't recommend it.
Well, I thank you so much for being on our show. It's always fun talking with you. Al and Larry Ubell, Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn.
And the next time we're here, we'll go forth and fix, save energy, money,
and do it safely.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Al and Larry Ubell, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my executive producer, Jesse Lind.
Leonard Lopate and Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.